I am here with Simon Sebag Montefiore. Simon, thanks so much for joining me.
It's great to be with you finally.
Yeah. We've been on a WhatsApp thread together for quite some time. We won't divulge the other attendees, but it's great to finally meet you, however remotely. You have written these just marvelous magisterial histories. I'm reading two simultaneously, but you've written many others. But the two I'm reading, Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar, and Jerusalem, the biography, really combined, they offer just an amazing lens through which to look at the present. I mean, my interest in talking to you as a historian is to help me worry about the present and the near future. And I think you're uniquely well-placed to do that, given your expertise in both Russian history and the history of the Middle East. Before we jump in, can you just give me kind of a potted intellectual biography? What do you consider your areas of focus as a historian?
You know, my background was I did history at Cambridge University. Then bizarrely, I went into banking for a short, disastrous career. Mm. And then I went out to the Soviet Union as it disintegrated in the early 90s. And so that was really my training ground. That was a brilliant place, a fascinating place to see an empire falling apart. And I think for a young historian to see with their own eyes an empire falling apart is the best training you can have, better than books. And so that was a very interesting time. And then from that, I started to write about Russia, which I'd started really when I was at university. And I started writing about Catherine the Great and Potemkin.
Yeah,
and that was that's a subject that's become very relevant, of course, because they, apart from their very colorful sex life and amazing letters and their place in the Enlightenment, the Russian Enlightenment, they were also empire builders, and of course they conquered South Ukraine and Crimea and built all the cities that are now being fought over: Odessa, Sebastopol, Dnipro, and so on. And that led through a weird favor to me, in a way, from Vladimir Putin himself, to having access to Stalin's archives and being one of the first people to be able to work in those archives. And of course, that was the big thrill, really, starting to work on Stalin. And that's the book you're reading, Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar.
Yeah, not a cheerful subject. It's quite unbelievable how horrific history gets. One hopes one is not living in a period of history like some of the periods you've written about, but increasingly our present starts to begin to feel like we've entered the stream of history. I mean, I remember the first period of my life where I felt all of a sudden, okay, this is history with all of its dangers. It was immediately after 9/11. I just felt like, okay, my life, what I consider to be a normal life, sort of post-history, however naively that lands for you. After 9/11, I thought, oh, really anything can happen at any time. And this is the kind of thing that very unlucky people experience in history. And more, I mean, I don't think I've ever shaken that epiphany, but you know, one does try to go to sleep. But more and more, it seems like we can't quite escape the tide of history here. How do you, we're certainly going to jump into a discussion about the Middle East and the rise of anti-Semitism. I think we'll touch on the war in Ukraine. And, you know, as you know, Russia has its finger in the chaos on both of these sides of the world.
For sure.
I guess my first question is, as a historian, is your historian hat more or less always on as you read the newspaper, or do you too go to sleep at times thinking you're living in some post-historical period where normalcy will reign?
My historian hat is always on, and at the moment it's just impossible. It's very hard to sleep at all, and there's such turbulence. But also, it's fascinating to watch in the worst way. I think one goes back to some of those. You know, one of the great analysts of power in history, Lenin, you know, with that famous quote, you know, nothing happens for years, and then everything, years happen in weeks or days. Yeah. And of course, one always remembers how, you know, right before the Russian Revolution, he said to his wife, Krupskaya, I don't think the revolution's going to happen in my lifetime, you know. And then when they've had the first reports of the fall of the Tsar, he said, can it be true? Is this a hoax? So, you know, no one knows what's going to happen, even the most shrewd analysts. And of course, historians are terrible prophets, as, you know, the end of history and many other, you know, pieces by brilliant historians have shown. But I think the thing to understand at the moment is how exceptional the period that we were living through, that we grew up in, was, how extraordinary. And of course, we didn't realize it when we were in it so much. But the period from 45, 48, 50 to 9/11 or the election of Donald Trump or whatever, you know, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, even October 7th, you know, how exceptional was that period where, you know, the leaders of actually, you know, every president of the United States had kind of similar views of the world, you know, give or take small differences. They had a view of an internationalist view of a mission to the world. And where Soviet leaders, despite believing in world revolution and their mission to change the world, were also extremely conservative, really. And where, you know, people did respect the United Nations that was a supranational sanctuary of something called international law, which existed because people believed it existed. And where various views became taboo in most liberal democracies, anti-Semitism, where a great liberal reformation happened with gay rights and that and other advances, the pill, the right to abortion, all these things were kind of won in this kind of period, which I call in my world history the Great Liberal Reformation, because it was so radical, but of course we took it for granted. And all of these things will have to be fought for again and are now under threat. And that exceptional period, it's hard to think of a period where anything like that really existed. You know, maybe the Roman Empire, when the Roman Empire faced the Persians and the Sasanians, there were these kind of, you know, two polar powers that really kind of kept a sort of peace. But of course, it was a much more brutal world. And of course, the rest of the world was not included in those two powers. It was really just Mediterranean and the Near East.
Yeah.
So the end of this world is a sort of return to the way things have always been, with massive number of powers. I guess you'd say, you know, the sort of the 70-year peace is what was coming to an end, what you were witnessing coming to an end, beginning to end with 9/11, which included a sort of chess game between two great powers. Then 25 years of American paramountcy, a sort of game of solitaire. And now suddenly, fascinatingly, a sort of multiplayer game where smaller powers follow their own interests in ways that we don't understand. And then, of course, the success, the key thing about this was the success of liberal democracy, which again was extraordinary. And one forgets that, you know, the European, half of Europe was under dictatorship until 91. Even Western Europe, you know, was under dictatorships until 1974, 75. So again, one just forgets. A lot of it is perception. We've just forgets how recent all this is.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you think we've reached a point where the unraveling of liberal world order, as we've come to know it, has reached a point of no return, where you're expecting America to pull back, that multilateralism will be less and less effectual, and we're going to see a period of greater chaos globally, do you think we can pull back from the brink here and return to what we in our lifetime have considered more normal? I mean, the where if we can't get quite to all the way to Fukuyama, we can get to something like the expectation going forward is that liberal democracy and its however many discontents it has will prevail, or at least be the expected norm globally, and that there'll be enough power on that side of the equation so that, you know, despotism will still seem both pathological and anomalous.
I think that, first of all, I don't think history ever kind of repeats itself exactly. It never goes back. But that doesn't mean that democracy, liberal democracies, can't resurge and triumph. But that needs that needs changes within liberal democracies. I mean, America is still the greatest power that's ever existed in terms of military power, economy, and all sorts of other tests and measures. And American power is still the most dynamic force in the world game, if you like. But the democracies are having a huge crisis within themselves. And, you know, as Ibn Khaldun, the great Arab North African historian in the 14th century said, he said, like, great kingdoms don't fall because of military defeats or economic defeats. They fall because of psychological defeats, which is a very interesting concept. And he said, you know, the loss of Asabia, forgive my appalling Arab pronunciation, but the loss of cohesion, of solidarity, of values that hold together a society in a common goal. And this, of course, brings us to stuff that Fukuyama has written very well about, you know, overqualified, over-entitled population, et cetera, which, of course, these are things that are stopping democracies behaving with confidence. And if America regained its confidence, you know, America has a huge power to change things. But we should be under no illusion. The success of liberal democracy was not because there was, you know, liberal democracy was not just because liberal democracies are very nice to live under. It was also because liberal democracies were successful. And the biggest influence, I mean, people, when I wrote my world history, people said, why is there so much war in your world history? It's full of violence. And I said, well, of course, you know, wars are when everything is speeded up and intensified. You know, inventions, ingenuity, all of it happens during warfare. And we were seeing that now with drone warfare and what, you know, all this, all that's happening in the Middle East and Ukraine. That's another thing we can talk about. But the point is, the reason why there was such liberal democracy was so successful, everyone wanted to have a system that looked like a liberal democracy, even if it wasn't a liberal democracy, was because of the victory of World War II of 45. I mean, started with 1918, but then again in 1945, which was really it's a Soviet victory, but it was widely regarded as a victory of America, of American power. And that made, if you look at all the new states created after 1945 in the 60s, they all look like America. I mean, even China today, even Russia have presidencies, legislatures. I mean, it's all based on America because America set this standard, even though they were never democracies and certainly never liberal democracies. But the point was everyone wanted to look like America. And of course, a lot of these countries that we presumed were democracies maybe weren't as democratic as we thought all along anyway. And one only has to look at all the states created in Africa, for example, which are now disintegrating. That's another subject to discuss perhaps later. But it was a great compliment to America that many states became liberal democracies. It was a great compliment to the success of America in wars that were incredibly consequential and mattered. And also wars, let's be clear, that had clear victories.
Right.
It's very hard to achieve now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so I think we can focus many of our concerns through the nexus of the city of Jerusalem. I mean, so much of what ails us in terms of the past shattering and possible future shattering of our world can be, it doesn't capture everything, but it captures a lot when you look at the fixation of the three monotheisms on that single city. I remember reading Gershom Gorenberg's book, The End of Days, maybe 20 years ago or so. And, you know, this would be obvious to you as a historian, but this was the first time I realized that the destruction of a single building, the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the Temple Mount, could produce World War III, right? I mean, the level of religious fanaticism aimed at that single piece of real estate is such that the world's Muslims and Christians and Jews view it as a, I mean, it is a sacred symbol, but it is a non-negotiable one, right? I mean, it's not at all fungible. It seems there's nothing you could offer the world's 2.1 billion Muslims in trade for that single building that would be satisfactory. And so it is with the millennial expectations of evangelical Christians, perhaps even Christians more widely, who expect that the Messiah will return. And this is, you know, they're joined by Orthodox Jews in this expectation. Once the temple is rebuilt by the Jews there. And you go into this history in some detail in your book, Jerusalem. But let's talk about that, because it is amazing when you step back, certainly from a secular perspective, to realize that our world is essentially rigged to explode based on the millenarian superstitions of billions of people focused on a single building and certain, you know, patently absurd details like the production of a perfect red heifer to be sacrificed. Yes. So as to sanctify the implements that would rebuild the temple. What are your thoughts on the Temple Mount, Simon?
Well, the Temple Mount is the most intensely revered piece of land. It's a compound, an esplanade. It's a platform actually built by Herod the Great, you know, created by Herod the Great during his reign. It took most of his reign to build it. And Herod the Great actually sort of formed what we now think of as the Temple Mount on a much rougher structure. And it hasn't, you know, the actual sort of space of the platform has not changed much since he built it. He was basically made king of Judea in 40 BC by Antony and Octavius, the future Augustus. And they walked with him through Rome and they said, go back and conquer Jerusalem and we'll give you some troops to do that. It had been taken by the Parthians. And so that's the sort of origin of the actual space as we see it now on which the two Islamic, beautiful Islamic shrines stand. And you're absolutely right. I mean, all of the expectations of fundamental believers of all the three Abrahamic religions are focused on that space. And many of them believe that outside the Golden Gate, which is the Eastern Wall, beautiful structure, probably built by Heraclius, the Byzantine emperor, on the eastern side, believe that that is the place that the apocalypse will happen. And you're absolutely right. I mean, when I was writing about Jerusalem and I sort of realized, you know, so many things could go right. This could be shared. There could be a peace process that could lead to this being a sort of international, the Holy Basin, as it's called by American peacemakers, that it could turn into a place, a sort of Vatican almost for all three religions. But it could also, anything that goes wrong there could ignite a catastrophe, a Holocaust, a world war III that would involve everybody, because everybody is involved in the future of that place. And that's why it's an extraordinary thing. And I guess one of the realizations today is that for years we thought, again, going back to our sort of view of the world until 9/11, we knew there were religious people. There were many evangelicals in America, and West Africa. There were Islamic fundamentalists and so on. There were Jewish fanatics. But we felt that along with liberal democracy, a sort of secularity was kind of spreading across the world and we were beyond that sort of religiosity.
Yeah.
Of course, that's turned out to be completely false. And actually, you know, religious people have a sort of force and a focus that secular people don't have, but which secular people are afraid of and are extremely impressed by. And so we're seeing that on the sides taken by different people in the Middle East right now. Of course, you know, it's not a coincidence that space is revered by the three religions, because each one led to another in a succession. And the holiness of each was borrowed, commandeered, stolen, reinvented, rechanneled by its successor. And each successor retooled, relaunched, and sort of slightly changed those stories in order to contribute to the heritage, to the ancientness that is essential for legitimacy in religion. And then, of course, that's why when you look at texts like the Bible, for example, the Quran, others, some of the texts sort of seem like very clear writing. Some of it is literally history that we can check. And some of it is unintelligible or weirdly detailed, like the famous red heifer in Jerusalem. Mm. But the point is, these texts are a mixture of a library of ancient texts that have been superimposed on each other. And the most holy thing is the revelation that builds on an ancient story that already exists, an ancient holiness that already exists. And this concept of holiness is redoubled, multiplied many times by the destruction of those places. So the destructions of Jerusalem, two most famous destructions, Nebuchadnezzar in 586 and Titus in 70, but there were many, many catastrophic events there. But especially those are so mythic in scale and so total that the very ruins became holier than the buildings that they'd replaced. And of course, they became hallowed by the legitimacy, by the authority, by the ancientness of what had gone before. So, you know, the revelation of the, it was a coincidence that Jerusalem became the holy city. Could have been many different places.
Mm.
Though a religious person wouldn't say that, of course. But, you know, historically, talking about geostrategy, there was no reason why Jerusalem should become such a significant place. It wasn't a port. It wasn't on a trade route. It was a small hilltop, mountaintop in the blistered Judean mountains in Canaan, what became known as Judea. But once the Jews had made it their holy city, once they'd written, the decisive thing that happened was not the decision, I think, not just the decision to make it the holy place and to build a temple there, but to write it down. And that was what was special about it, because Jerusalem gained a biography, the Bible. And that biography meant that other people could read it, could find out about it, could be translated, it could be known by successors. And so the early Christians were of course Jews, despite what you might read on Twitter these days, or on X these days.
Yeah. Actually, that's a point that I hadn't thought to raise with you, but I've always found it fascinating that the certainly theological versions of anti-Semitism are a kind of reductio ad absurdum of themselves when you realize that Jesus and Mary and all of Jesus's disciples were Jews, living as Jews, acting as Jews, thinking of themselves as Jews. It's amazing that you can get a genocidal anti-Semitism out of that piece of legacy code somehow. In a Christian context, it's probably less surprising in a Muslim context. But perhaps we can just talk about the roots of this intersection of religious belief on the Holy Land, you know, more broadly. One thing that was also surprising to learn in your book is that Jerusalem itself has been abandoned, or effectively abandoned, at various periods in history. I mean, it became essentially a little village of ruins. But let's talk about the roots here, because I'm going to want to lead you in this conversation to an analysis of what's happened post October 7th, and with notions of, you know, settler colonialism and the illegitimacy of Jewish claims to that particular piece of real estate, and the view worldwide that the Jews and the nation of Israel are interlopers of a kind and a remnant of colonialism. So knowing that we're going to get there, let's talk a little bit about the history of the region, of Jews in the region, and of the emergence of Christianity and Islam out of that region.
The Judeans, which was, the word Jew comes from Judean. The Judeans were one of the Levantine people who emerged in Canaan and controlled between about 1000 BC and about, you know, the beginning of the new, for about 1000 years, or about 10 centuries, lived in kingdoms that they mainly ruled in the small land that was around Jerusalem. If you were a believing Jew, you'd say that they were the chosen people who came out of Egypt in the Passover story, and you would believe that they were the chosen people. If you're a secular person and look at history, you would say that they were one of the peoples that emerged from Levantine Canaanite peoples who lived in the region, that they created kingdoms north, a kingdom called Israel, in the south, a kingdom ruled by a house of David, which appears on the Tel Dan stele. So we know that there was a house of David, and that David and his successors in the house of David, a dynasty, ruled from Jerusalem, that they built a temple there at some point, maybe not as early as, it's impossible to prove when it was exactly built, but it was built, and that was the first temple. It was built what is now the Temple Mount, Mount Moriah, in Jerusalem, and there was a northern kingdom, Israel, they were tiny kingdoms that really prospered during a period when the great powers of the region, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, and so on, were in times of crisis. When those big empires woke up again and were restored to power, they swept down and conquered these kingdoms. The peoples of Israel were removed to Babylonian exile. Jerusalem was destroyed in 586, but the Judean people remained there. In 63, well, in the 320s, Alexander the Great arrived. His successors, two kingdoms, the Seleucids and the Assyrians, ruled Syria and Egypt and fought for about 100 years for control of Judea and Jerusalem. 164, they rebelled against the Assyrians, created a new kingdom, the Maccabean kingdom, the Hasmonean kingdom.
Mm. We're still BC here, right?
Yes, is celebrated by Jews in the festival of Hanukkah. And they ruled for about 100 years. Mm. And then they broke up in civil war. Some people make parallels with Israel today, with that process where that kingdom disintegrated. And then the Romans arrived in about 63 in the person of Pompey the Great, a great Roman warlord. And, then his successors gave Judea to Herod the Great, who was a fascinating character, a key character, because his mother was Arab. She was Nabataean, which was the Arab kingdom in what is now Jordan and northern Saudi Arabia. And his father was an Edomian, an Edomite, a recent convert to Judaism. And so he's an interesting person, half Arab, half Jew, half Judean, if you like. Mm. And he created a dynasty that lasted for five generations, ruling various bits of Roman-dominated Near East. And in 66, there was a huge rebellion against the Romans during the reign of Nero, partly caused by Nero's managerial incompetence in his rule of the empire.
And winning personality.
And winning personality, yeah. general sinister character. And, he was one of, Nero is interesting because he's one of those politicians who merges entertainment and politics, which we should be familiar with today, and use the power of entertainment and the power of politics to feed on each other to promote himself. But moving aside from that, there was the Jewish revolt led by fundamentalist Jewish fanatics, I think we'd say now, and many of the Judean people backed the Romans. And in fact, the Herod family were one of the historian Josephus actually, mm-hmm. in the end backed the Romans, thinking Roman Hellenic life was preferable to life under a Jewish religious state.
These are the Maccabees?
These weren't the Maccabees. These were different sects and factions that fought each other murderously. And in the end, were stormed by Titus Caesar, the son of the Emperor Vespasian, who emerged out of the civil war of 68, the year of three emperors, mm-hmm. and stormed Jerusalem and destroyed it for the second time completely. Many Jews then went into exile, but many Jews remained there. And in the 130s, another emperor, Hadrian, decided to build a Roman temple on top of the ruins of the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, of the second temple, which had been destroyed. And this caused a second huge Jewish revolt led by Simon Bar Kokhba. And once again, this led to what everyone agrees is it was a genocidal war against the Judeans. They were banned from Jerusalem. Jerusalem was renamed Aelia Capitolina and remained under a new name for 300 years. But the Jews or Judeans always revered it, prayed around its ruins, but were spread around the Mediterranean for the first time. So there was a glut of Judean slaves, for example, in Rome. It's funny to think of Jews as slaves. But there was many of the slaves in the Roman Empire were Judean, of course, because after these wars. And out of this came a new Jewish religion that was always linked and looked back to Jerusalem, but also looked to the Torah as a kind of portable Jerusalem almost, which they carried with them always. And the religion changed fundamentally. Before then, Jewish religion had been based on sacrifices on the Temple Mount, outside the temple, to God. And since they no longer had the temple and they no longer had access to the Temple Mount itself, a new sort of religion developed, which where Jews prayed in synagogues and they lived, you know, in Spain, in Italy, in Cyprus, in North Africa. So that was a new era. And at the same time, the Christian religion had separated itself from Judaism. Jesus, Joseph, Mary, their family were Jews. The Judeans were Judeans, but they lived were known as Nazarenes because they came from Galilee. And in the early part of the Christian story, they were really a Jewish sect. They prayed, they followed one of Jesus's brothers or cousins, James. They prayed in the temple like other Jews. And it was only really after 70, after the destruction of the temple had shown many that God had withdrawn his blessing from the Jews. Again, war, failure in war is so decisive in history. Mm. And that many decided that actually they needed to embrace a new revelation in the revelation of Christianity. And of course, it was the preaching of Christianity to non-Jews and the fact that Christianity would open their arms completely to non-Jews that partly made it so successful. But it was also, it's a rebellion against the class structure in the Roman Empire, enslavement. And also it had a new concept, which was if you behave well in this life, you'd go to heaven in the next one. So salvation. So was a promise. And so it contained new things that have really affected us right until this day. And the conversion of Constantine to in the fourth century, Constantine, the ruler of the whole Roman Empire, the conversion to Christianity was a decisive moment in world history and made and really allied Christianity with power, with state, with empire, and Jesus with war and victory. 300 years later, in Arabia, emerged the revelation of the prophet Muhammad. He claimed to speak as a messenger of God, but he was knowledgeable about both Christian and Jewish religion. And whether he read it or he heard of it, he'd certainly traveled with members of his family who were merchants to Syria, to Judea, to Palestine. And so he embraced these stories as prophets. He embraced Moses and David. He embraced Mary. He embraced these people, Jesus, as prophets in his new third and final revelation. And part of the success of Muhammad was based on what seemed like an eclipse of the Roman Empire in a time that must have seemed like a sort of world disaster. After he died in 632, but in the early part of that century, the Sasanian Persians invaded the Eastern Roman Empire, defeated it, took Egypt, Jerusalem, and fought their way all the way to close to Istanbul. And the world seemed to be tilting in an extraordinary way. No one knew what would happen. And during that period, the two great powers, the Sasanian Persian Shahs and the emperors in Constantinople, had formally financed proxy kingdoms of Arabs that fought as their kind of border proxies in the Middle East. And they discontinued these pensions that they paid to these local kings, these Arab kings. So there's always been a great mystery, like how'd come these Arabs from great obscurity managed to conquer so much of the world. And part of it was religious fervor. Part of it was military toughness. Part of it was sort of military efficiency, a centrality of belief. And part of it may have been that there were these kind of actually sort of experienced and trained warriors around, trained by both superpowers, if you like, who were available. But anyway, Muhammad was not only the founder of a religion like Jesus Christ, but he was also a head of state and a commander who created a new community and a new state. And his successors sent their troops out into the world, and a world that was completely destabilized. And the early, it seems like nothing is certain of that period. It's such a misty period. But it seems like they very shrewdly offered all monotheists the chance to join this religion, which at the time had rules that were unclear, that were inchoate, that were developing. And there are, for example, in Jerusalem, there are very clear records that when they took Jerusalem, first of all, it was surrendered to them by Christian bishop without fighting and in return for tolerance. But secondly, that when they arrived there, they immediately went up to the Temple Mount, which had been left empty as a sign of Christian disdain for the Jews. And they built an early mosque there on the site of the Al-Aqsa. Mm. And they also later built the Dome of the Rock in 691 on the site, almost certainly on the site of the Judean or Jewish temple. But in those early mosques and the early Dome of the Rock, Christians and Jews were allowed, it's believed, to pray there as well. And of course, the rules hardened later as the religion became the formal faith of the great Arab empire. But all that time, Jews had been there in that region, had prayed around the walls. And when the Muslims came, they allowed the Jews to return to live there, providing, as Dhimmi, they recognized the supremacy of the Islamic religion and the Islamic state. And that was the basis in which Jews lived there for many centuries to come.
Mm. So how do you understand the roots of anti-Semitism? I mean, I guess the simplest theological rationale for it is that the persistence of Jews as Jews is just logically a repudiation of the core of both Christianity and Islam, right? It is the non-acceptance of those later revelations as superseding Judaism, right? I mean, if you don't accept Jesus as the Messiah as a Jew, well, then you have repudiated Christianity. If you don't accept the final perfect revelation of Muhammad, you are, you know, by definition, not a Muslim, and therefore your attachment to your prior faith as a Jew is inimical to the truth from the point of view of those two faiths. Is that the seed crystal of anti-Semitism from your point of view?
Yes. And of course, in both the histories of both religions, there are moments when Jews were involved in Jesus's case, the arrest of Jesus, and in the rise of Muhammad, the point where Jewish tribes rejected his rule, and where he massacred those tribes. So in both cases, there are moments of real history where in the very early stages of those religions, where Jews rejected the revelation. And, you know, both of those are in a misty part of history that is close to legend, and we don't actually know what happened. But certainly the Jewish high priests who ruled the temple and the Temple Mount under Roman power rejected Jesus, and Jesus criticized them. They were probably a very corrupt elite, and they were threatened by Jesus. Jesus preached against them and preached against their corruption. And what happened in the arrest and execution of Jesus isn't known. But one thing is clear: crucifixion is a Roman execution, form of execution.
Mm.
And it's not a Jewish form of execution at all. And so, you know, about the only thing we're absolutely certain about is that he was not executed by Jews, but by Romans. Everything else is questionable. You know, all we have really is a very small mention in Tacitus, and then of course the Gospels, with the Christian Gospels, which by their nature are biased. But even they, you know, even they don't deny the Roman part in the execution of Jesus. So, but you're right, from the beginning, many Jews rejected the revelation of Jesus, and the position was fine as long as Christianity didn't become a state religion, but when it became a state religion with Constantine the Great, then the existence of the Jews, which had been tolerated perfectly happily under the Roman Empire, providing that they didn't rebel politically, they were regarded as somewhat strange, believing in only one God. But because they were very ancient, they were respected. But when they resisted the new faith of the Roman Empire, newly converted, then they began to be regarded as a sort of political and religious insult, as you said. And so it's really from that period that anti-Semitism really started in the Byzantine official state policy, which actually became more and more anti-Jewish. Mm. And it was they who specifically, the Eastern Roman Empire, we called them the Byzantines later, but they called themselves Romans, Romaioi, they were Greek-speaking, and they ruled from Constantinople. And they passed a series of increasingly stringent anti-Jewish laws, which in many ways are the sort of basis for much of anti-Semitism, the persecution of Jews, the banning of religion, that they were no longer allowed to own property, and they were not allowed onto the Temple Mount. And there are scenes that St. Jerome writes about where, you know, on the anniversary of the fall of the Temple or in great festivals, Jews would travel hundreds of miles to gather around the walls of the Temple, the walls which still stood, and rent their garments and pray. So in that story, you have both the birth of anti-Semitism and, of course, evidence that the Jews revered Jerusalem a very long time ago, historically. And the religion was tolerated as a dhimmi people, providing they paid a tax, the jizya tax, to the Islamic rulers, and providing they never challenged, of course, the Islamic religion itself, they didn't try and convert anybody, and that they recognized totally Islamic political and religious supremacy, which most Jewish people, you know, did in return for survival. I think it's also true, and it's a sort of story we don't really know, but many, many Jews must have converted to Christianity, and many, many Jews must have converted to Islam in those early years. So that was the Jewish destiny in the Near East, if you like. In the Middle Ages, many Jews found themselves living in the new cities of the West, in Paris, in Spain, in Italy. And those Jews were now outsiders in a universally Christian society that, of course, lived on reading the Bible and knew the Bible absolutely backwards. And so they were a living rebuke to the state religion of Christianity, as it was. And so they inherited the anti-Semitism that we saw in the Byzantine Empire, that regarded the Jews as responsible for the killing Christ. But also, you're right, it was their otherness, the fact that they preserved these traditions when other religions had said, right, fine, we're military defeated, we will just merge with the ascendant victorious religion, this ascendant culture. And I think it was because the Jews had a written history that defined them so clearly, and they were the only people to do so in such an ancient tradition, that they were able to do so. But it also made them obnoxious to many people, but that living rebuke, but also the presence of their in societies that were totally Christian, made their otherness seem alien, seem dangerous even.
Mm-hmm.
And in societies that couldn't explain scientific phenomenon, pestilence, plagues, and so on, you know, they looked at the foreigner, the outsider, the alien to blame for that. And many of the tropes of anti-Semitism come from that. You know, the idea of Jews which the Nazis took up as a bacteria in a healthy society, for example. The murder of a child in a town could lead to accusations of the blood libel, you know, as happened in British city, yeah. British in English cities. And these merged with the fact that they were a clearly foreign people in the midst of a country.
You had the imaginary crime of host desecration, once you believe indeed that the body of Jesus is really present in every, you know, cracker of the Eucharist, what could be more plausible than that the Jews would want to torture the body of Jesus again if they could only get hold of these crackers and drive nails into them? So you'd have, there are records of thousands of Jews being murdered by their neighbors for the crime of mistreating crackers. Or imagined. One presumes no Jew actually ever grabbed the communion host and tortured it. But
well, I'm sure no Jew either murdered any Christian children in order to use their blood to make other biscuits.
To make matzah, yes, exactly.
Yeah. That also seems unlikely, but was believed widely all over. And I think, you know, these stories, once stories are canonized, but are written. Once they're written down into a literature, there's always going to be people that believe them. Right. And of course, you know, I think when things spread by word of mouth, that was one thing. When printing started, that meant that these stories had authority when they appeared written down. And so the more sophisticated media comes, the quicker these stories can be propagated and the more they can be believed because they have the authority of the medium. So, of course, you know, printing, and then, of course, you know, in our own, that's the attraction of the digital world. These media have authority, which is undeserved, obviously, because information is only as good as the source you put into it, obviously. But going back to the Middle Ages, the Crusades were a key moment in the development of anti-Semitism, in the practice of anti-Semitism, because the concept of holy war, invented by Urban IV when he declared in 1095, or borrowed from Islam, but borrowed from Islam and possibly from Heraclius, the emperor who declared holy war to retake Jerusalem in the 7th century. But this medieval version was based on the destruction of the other. And it's an extraordinary thing, the Crusade, between 1095 and 1099, over 100,000 people, you know, some of them princes, some of them merchants, and many of them just ordinary people, some of them paupers, gathered together in cities from London to Paris and just wended their way in small or large groups to fight their way to the Holy Land. And the idea was the Holy Land is ruled by the infidel, the Turks, the Arabs, the Muslims, and Jerusalem itself, the place of Christ's crucifixion, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, is in peril. And so here's one of those cases that you were referring to at the beginning of this thing. You know, what happened, this talk, when what happens when a totally revered site, a shrine, is in danger? We immediately reach for our sword. And hundreds of thousands of people at a time when the population of Europe was pretty tiny, so it's a vast number, went there. And as they traveled there, the first kind of infidels they came across were Jews living in their big cities, in cities in Germany, in Hungary, and they killed all of the ones they could find. And then they fought their way all the way around the Eastern Mediterranean. And a tiny, tiny number of that 100 or 120,000 people arrived outside Jerusalem in July 1099. There may have been as few as 12,000 crusaders made it there. And with the help of Italian sailors who dismantled their boats at Jaffa and brought the wood across across the relatively short distance to Jerusalem and built siege machines, they stormed Jerusalem on the 15th of July. And when the population of Jerusalem, it's always described as sort of 70,000, 100,000, it's probably much less, it was probably 20,000. And that included a Fatimid Egyptian garrison, a governor, and then an Arab, Turkish, and Jewish population. And it's often forgotten that when they took the city, they massacred everybody they found in Jerusalem, except people they could identify as very wealthy with connections to Cairo. And they were ransomed. So very few, luckily, were survived. But virtually everybody in that 20,000 were killed in cold blood. And the sources say that there was so much blood that the horses rode up to their bridles in blood. And when they made it to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, they were just covered in blood. They were just drenched in blood, and they kind of gloried in showing the blood on their clothes and hands. So a chilling moment. And it's perhaps an interesting point to make. It's so destructive in the way that they massacred everybody in this kind of spectacular, ostentatious killing that the one of modern event that reminds me of it is October the 7th, you know, more than any other, funny enough. And of course, that comes to the nature of October the 7th, which in many ways is alien to Arab and Islamic culture in the long reach of history, where, you know, actually, when Saladin retook Jerusalem in 1187, there was no massacre. Jews were settled in the city again. And this is a, that's a tradition of Islam that is utterly admirable. So what does October the 7th, it's interesting that October the 7th is more similar to a Christian storming of Jerusalem than anything else. And that comes to the nature of Islamism, of Hamas's Islamism, which is a very recent invention in Islam. And Hamas is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood that was invented by al-Banna in Egypt in 1928. And the other half of its peculiar genocidal racism is, of course, totally based on Nazism, on European fascism, European racism. So its foreignness to the region is not so surprising.
Yeah, well, there's a lot there. I think I'm more, perhaps I'm more worried about the source code of the three monotheisms than you are, in the sense that I don't think, if you go back to the roots in Islam or Christianity or even Judaism, I don't think you find a recipe for durable tolerance, right? I mean, I think you, you know, it's not an accident that even the great lights of Christianity, like Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, thought you could get essentially a logic of the Inquisition out of the gospel, right? I mean, we get this desire. I forget if it's Augustine who thought heretics should be tortured and Aquinas thought they should be killed, or vice versa. But in neither case do you get what we would recognize as 21st century tolerance of free thought, even in the great thinkers of Christianity. And Christianity, you know, is often thought of as a pacifist counterpoint to certainly what you find in the Old Testament, like Deuteronomy and Exodus and Leviticus, which, as you detail briefly in this conversation and at greater length in your book, gave you a kind of Taliban-style theocracy in the ancient Judaism. And
for sure.
Yeah. And so it is with Islam. I mean, I think the apostasy and blasphemy as a killing offense, the example of Muhammad, you know, as not just as a radical prophet, but as a conquering warlord who, you know, for whom decapitation was all in a day's work. I think there are many reasons to worry that a reversion to that there's no place to really set your way back machine historically so as to find a benign version of these faiths eager to live in proximity to all others in a pluralistic world and to share power.
That's right. I mean, if you accept an absolutist version, if you're a fundamentalist believer of Christianity, but particularly Judaism and Islam, there is no way to compromise. And it's the spread of those views that can engender a sort of feeling of hopelessness, because, you know, the only way forward is for both societies to reject those extremisms. And it's actually impossible for any outside power, even America, to alter those things. Those societies have to decide their own destiny. We can't decide for them, even though it's extremely tempting. It doesn't matter how many peace envoys we send to speak to them. If it's a battle of religions, if it's a battle of absolutist faiths, then it's a war to the death. If it's a matter of secular statesmen, it's a border dispute.
Yeah.
And let's negotiate. You know, a great Saudi foreign minister said that, but that's actually a very neat way of putting it. And as long as it's a religious dispute, it's unnegotiable. And that is one of the tragedies of the time and the place. But all is not lost, because, you know, vast sections of these societies actually are not ruled by Islamists, you know, and they may not have systems that we approve of as liberal democracies, but who are we to tell them how to run their countries? But the point is that there is a huge seam of Arab and Islamic culture and society that don't want to exist by the sword at all. And, you know, obviously part of the art of statesmanship in the Middle East is to is to embrace those powers and encourage them. And there are optimists. I mean, this is a time when we are all, you know, in a time of seeming despair. But in both societies, in both worlds, Jewish and Muslim and Arab, you know, there are powers with optimistic views, you know, of how the Middle East could work without this sort of brutal world of slaughter and conquest.
Yeah, ironically, the population that I think is most tired of theocracy is the Iranian population, right? I mean, Iran, the republic, the theocracy on top of the population is responsible for much, if even most, of the mayhem in the Middle East at the moment. But the people in Iran really sound like they're ready to be done with the theocrats.
100%. And I think that is an extremely, that regime is deeply repressive to its own people. But more than that, its foreign policy has been, well, apart from being the most successful Persian state since the Sasanians in the 7th century, probably, or certainly since the 18th century of Nadir Shah, they were able to extend their power using proxies all the way to the Mediterranean, which is extraordinary, through Iraq, through Syria, through Lebanon, and it's an astounding success and something that actually the United States, when we write the history of the early 21st century, United States foreign policy may look upon allowing that as one of the most grievous mistakes of the last 25 years, from which so much disaster has come. And one of the things that, you know, we started this conversation talking about victory, which is a very unfashionable word these days, but it basically means being unafraid to win and back your friends. And I think, you know, the great American self-doubt in its foreign policy in the last 20 years has allowed great disasters to happen in the Middle East.
Mm. Well, I want to bring you back to the most recent great disaster and the world's response to it, which might even be a greater disaster, right? I'm talking about October 7th and the eruption of anti-Semitism we saw the world over in response. Really, and it almost seemed impossible given that it happened before Israel did anything in response to the atrocities committed by Hamas on that day. I mean, literally within 24 hours, you had some of the ostensibly most educated people in our society blaming Israel for having suffered a massacre and lionizing Hamas as a totally legitimate resistance operation. And then the confusion just spiraled from there. And there's, I mean, I think it's, if we were going to extend a principle of charity to the confused here, I think we can admit that there are layers to this moral confusion and his anti-Semitic character. And some of it strikes me as not frank anti-Semitism. I mean, it's effective anti-Semitism. But I think if you went to many of the college campuses where these protests erupted and just could have a searching conversation with the participants, these college students at Harvard and Stanford and Columbia, et cetera, you would not detect in them real anti-Semitism of a sort, real Jew hatred of a sort that we usually associate with anti-Semitism. And they're not ruled by the theology of the 14th century Christendom or of modern Islamism or jihadism. Rather, I think what you have are, for the most part, liberal Westerners who have been taken in by certain streams of misinformation, and some of this has been consciously engineered, I would say, by Islamists, and we can talk about that. But they're also taken in by their better intentions, right? Their moral scruples, their sense that the West has a lot to apologize for, that the history of, you know, slavery and colonialism is such that white people in the developed world are culpable for all of the inequality and much of the misery we see in the world, and that Israel as a state kind of fall on the wrong side of that dichotomy, right? That the Jews are colonialists, and that, you know, and that Israel as a state is a vestige of imperialism, and that Jews are the white people in the region, as confused as that is genealogically, that's the belief. And therefore, you get this sort of mapping, especially in an American context, of the American civil rights movement and its, you know, all the history it has to apologize for. You map that onto the Middle East, and the Arabs are effectively black and the Jews are effectively white. And here we get some sort of post-Reconstruction lingering supremacy and an apartheid-like unfairness that has to be accounted for and changed. The status quo in the region is insufferable. And all the onus seems to fall on the Jewish side. Again, this is a powerful species of confusion, but it's not anti-Semitism of a sort that we tend to think about. And yet at its core, obviously, there's a fair amount of anti-Semitism and malicious gaming of social media and the spreading of misinformation, all designed to inflame these best intentions and to amplify this confusion. And this comes from, you know, the far right and Islamists, and you know, there are frank strands of anti-Semitism on the far left as well. I realize I've given you a very unbalanced and chaotic object to interact with here, but how do you view the eruption of anti-Semitism post October 7th? What do you think we do about it?
Well, I mean, I think first of all, it was just an extraordinary thing, and it was a terrible shock. And I think to see, you know, the day after, or the day of, you know, this slaughter, this rapine, this hunt for human trophies, to see people on university campuses, people we respected, celebrating, was a terrifying and tragic moment. And I think, among other things, for Jewish people, just in Jewish history, I think what we saw, and events since then in the last year have confirmed this, the sort of end of the golden age of tolerance for Jew, you know, of Jewish life in the West, and nothing less than that, which is a tragedy. One can now see there was a sort of golden age after World War II, after 1948, that really endured until pretty recently. And I think we didn't realize how much we had ceded power in our universities, for example, to ideologies that we really didn't understand or notice, for that matter, or care about that much, and that they developed without us really understanding them or taking the trouble to judge. And so, you know, you described, I guess, the essence of one part of it, which is the progressive part, where the American civil rights movement, the idea of racial identity, the history of race, the tortured history of race and slavery in American history, was applied to the Middle East, a complicated, cosmopolitan, multi-faith, multi-ethnic region that really had no parallel whatsoever to the experience of African Americans and enslavement in America at all, but which was an ideology that became a dominant stream of thought, a lens through which to judge the world. And of course, that civil rights ideology was also merged with the struggle ideology of decolonization, which justified any resistance against the heirs of Western criminal empire building in history. But to look at all this and apply all this to the creation of Israel and the creation of the Middle East requires not just misguided good intentions, but also a grotesque lack of knowledge of what really happened. And I mean, the interesting thing is that not all of it was as you say, traditional anti-Semitism in terms of things like the blood libel or the master race that the Nazis believed in. So there wasn't the sort of blatant racism that you might have found in 13th century Lincoln or 1930s Berlin. But it was very quickly those tropes and images and traditions that were buried deep in Western culture were dug out and deployed to support an ideology that was initially probably well-intentioned and based on ignorance. And we've now seen the merging of those two things, and do so all the time, from both the far right and progressive people. Mm. One of the strange inheritances of the wonderful period between the 40s and the early 21st century, when anti-Semitism was a taboo in most societies in the world, one of the great hangovers from that was a sort of formal anti-racism in which you could say anything, providing you said you were also anti-racist.
Mm.
And part of that was the cult of the Holocaust, which has in many ways, in a what I call a sort of terrifying dark mirroring, being used against Jewish people and against Israel. And I don't think Israel is complete. I don't think Israeli leaders have actually been wise in their overuse of this imagery either. And I think they must take some blame for extremely coarse and short-sighted overuse of these ideas as well. And they have to bear some responsibility. But overall, the merging of medieval anti-Semitism, 19th century and early 20th century anti-Semitism, with progressive decolonization has created a sort of extraordinary new version of anti-Semitism that is self-described as anti-racist, but is in fact highly racist. And one of the most disgusting parts of it, to me as a historian, is, as I said, the dark mirroring, the inversion of Jewish history to be used against Jews. And it started early in the 21st century with the claim that Gaza was like the Warsaw Ghetto, for example. So that strain of thinking, of course, started in the Soviet Union as a deliberate anti-American, anti-Zionist ideology in the late 50s and early 60s, and was written about in policy papers promoted by gifted Soviet leaders like Yuri Andropov, who ran the KGB for a long time, was chairman of the KGB for a long time, and was secretly Jewish, it turns out, interestingly.
Mm.
And of course, that idea was spread in Soviet propaganda to many of the liberation movements whose successors rule places like South Africa, you know, which is why the ANC, for example, has adopted this view and also adopted a very pro-Russian policy in the Ukraine, for example. So that was the origin of these sort of meandering strains of thought. But the misuse of Jewish history and Jewish suffering against Jews today is a thoroughly disgusting form of this modern anti-Semitism. And you regularly see Jews described as sort of having massive power in the media or massive power over American society now without much challenge. So that's one part of it. So there's this kind of myth of Jewish power, there's dark Jewish history inverted so that Palestinians become the Jews in this story or the African Americans in this story. Mm. And of course, as you said, that requires this preposterous leap and the judgment of Jews in Western societies as a privileged elite, too privileged to suffer racism, and therefore a denial and an erasure of Jewish history, even recent Jewish history like the Holocaust, in a really repellent manner. And we've seen that from Hollywood stars and others, you know, who've been called out. So there's a sort of a massive erasure and distortion in our own societies. And then we look at the Middle East, this incredibly complex region. And there you have to make the leap that the Jewish people have no connection to Judea, Israel, and are white colonizers. And that brings us to the concept of settler colonialism, which is the essential part of the decolonization ideology, which has been embraced by many university professors and students. And like all ideologies, Marxism, for example, there are strands of truth buried under layers of lies and distortions. And so the truth of the story of settler colonialism is that, yes, many Jews between the 1880s and the 1950s emigrated back to the Holy Land and there practiced what they called the building of colonies. And those colonies were not a case of colonization in the sense that a superior power sends people out to conquer an indigenous people. In this case, as we've talked in the last minutes, you know, they were an indigenous people with a very ancient link to that land. There had always been Jews living there throughout history. But some Jewish people between the 1880s, mainly from Russia and Eastern Europe, did move to build these colonies. And the colonies they were building were colonies in the sense of artist colonies, small agricultural communities that they called colonies, and which were not part of a huge plan to necessarily build a state in the area at all, and did not require the removal of anybody from what was then part of the Ottoman Empire.
Mm.
And they joined their Jews who had always been there, who had lived in the Arab Islamic world for millennia. And so they were not a colonial power in the way that decolonization is understood at all. The phrase settler colonialism has come to mean something that is neither involved settlement or colonialization, but is a particular ideological jargon, rather like dictatorship of the proletariat.
Or mm-hmm.
You can take any number of Marxist class consciousness. You can take any number of Marxist jargons. But these people did settle there. They did build smaller agricultural communities. And in the 1950s, after the foundation of the State of Israel, the huge Jewish population, 700,000 or 800,000 Sephardic Jews who lived in Arab countries, Egypt, Iraq, Iran, Syria, were expelled from their countries and moved to Israel. And of course, they had lived in the Arab and Islamic world in the Middle East and were indigenous to the Middle East and had never gone anywhere. So in both cases, these were not white people settling in a foreign land as either empire builders or colonizers. And so it's a basic misunderstanding of the history of the creation of Israel. And I would just say, you know, part of this is a sort of belief that Israel is a sort of the only new country created there. And it's very new and it doesn't really belong there. And it was only created by the British Empire. But actually, you need to look at the history of the creation of the modern Middle East. All of it was created by the fall of the Ottoman Empire. One might argue that the fall of the Ottoman Empire was a terrible tragedy. But that's another debate for another time.
Mm-hmm.
But all of the states of the modern Middle East, Iraq, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, all of these countries had never existed before. Egypt had existed as an ancient civilization for millennia. And of course, Iran, Persia had existed. But the other ones had never existed as separate states with these borders. Iraq was invented out of three vilayets, Ottoman vilayets, provinces. The French invented Syria, Lebanon, divided into two countries. And Lebanon is, in fact, an example of what happens when you attempt a one-state solution with multi-ethnic population. And all of these countries were invented between 1931 and 1950, basically. And all of them were new. And all of them were created by either the United Nations or, more commonly, the British and French empires. And by the way, all of them are failed states except Israel in one way or another. If you look at these new states that were formed in the 1940s, newly formed, Lebanon, you know, Syria, 500,000 people have been killed in Syria in a civil war over the last 10 years by the Assad regime and others. Iraq, hundreds of thousands of people killed in the after the American invasion of 2003. And you just look at these countries, many of these ex-Ottoman countries are failed states. The most successful are the ones that weren't conquered by anybody, and that's true. And that's because they have oil, the Gulf monarchies, mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia and the Gulf monarchies. They, and many people argue, it's because they weren't created by the Western powers, but grew organically from their own societies. And that there may be some truth in that. Though, of course, the vast, limitless wealth of oil doesn't hurt either. So to any analysis of the area that isolates Israel from that imperial era is a gross distortion. Any history that claims that the Jews who went there, either from Russia and Eastern Europe or from the Arab world, were alien to that land is also a grotesque distortion. And the imposition of really crude and simplistic Western progressive ideologies, ironically invented in the Soviet Union.
Mm. Well, so what you have is Israel isolated by a widespread application of double standards, right? So you have this perpetual focus on the Palestinians as refugees and displaced people who should have a right of return, and you have no thought given whatsoever to the right of return of all the Jews who are run out of Iraq and Syria and Libya and all the surrounding countries, right? There's no thought to that. There's no thought to the fact that in their prosecution of their wars, the Israelis hold themselves to a standard of modern combat and the minimization of collateral damage that is not only unthinkable in the populations they're fighting, it's they're fighting people who use their own civilians as human shields, right? I mean, so it's everything is upside down with respect to the response to these differences. And inconveniently for us in describing these double standards, it begins to sound like an allegation of a widespread conspiracy theory, because, I mean, as you just said, so much of this has been engineered consciously by Russian misinformation.
Yes.
The Protocols of the Elders of Zion was a Russian convection.
It was.
And forgery. And yet this way of viewing the situation has been seeded into all of our institutions, right? Again, this sounds like an elaborate conspiracy theory, but when you look at the framing of this most recent conflict in Gaza and in Lebanon, that one finds in the BBC or at the UN or at charitable organizations like Amnesty International, it's on Wikipedia. I mean, you get this, the memification of a very biased and morally deluded view of an ancient conflict wherein I think it should be easy to see, if you could only look at this dispassionately, that Israel is a leaving aside a kind of rounding error of its own religious fanaticism, which, you know, we would both want to repudiate, and the political alliances with the far right have been at best inconvenient in the current government. But leaving aside the fact that there are a few fanatical Jews there who can sound like religious maniacs of a sort that they're fighting on the other side, what you have in Israel is an impressively secular democracy. It is really the functioning like the tip of the spear of Western civilization against trends in the Muslim world that endanger not only it, but endanger open societies everywhere. I mean, obviously, I'm talking about Islamism and jihadism. And it's of a piece with the kinds of violence we've seen expressed in Western Europe of late. I mean, we're talking now maybe a week after there was pogrom-like violence in the Netherlands in association with the soccer game, right?
Yeah.
I mean, again, to come back to the principle of charity I invoked, however ineffectually, some minutes ago in describing the moral confusion of the progressive left in America, one can only hope that a sufficiently detailed conversation could convert most of the students, certainly many of the students at our, you know, best universities, to seeing what is just patently so here, which is if you're, you know, an LGBTQ activist supporting Hamas, you are living in contradiction with yourself. If you can only just double click on what Hamas intends for the LGBTQ activists of the world, you have to recognize that your friends are in Tel Aviv, not in Gaza. And
that's right. I mean, these organizations, the Iran regime and Hezbollah, the Houthis, Hamas, are literally the enemies of everything we hold dear in our societies. And this isn't about a lack of empathy for civilians killed, because, you know, every single Israeli civilian, every single Palestinian civilian, we mourn for. You know, no man is an island. We see the suffering of these people, and it's agonizing to see. But at the same time, you know, we have to be clear that in this war, the Western liberal democracies have a natural ally in the Israeli democracy. It is a liberal democracy. There probably is a majority of Israelis who could or have believed in a two-state solution. Pretty hard to advocate it now in the midst of a desperate war of survival. there is also a large section of Israeli society that is embracing supremacist and actually anti-democratic and anti-liberal religious fundamentalism that, as I think we'd agree, we both reject. And the fact that this government of Netanyahu is heavily influenced by those small factions is extremely alarming and dangerous for the Middle East, and also complicated for those advocating for Israel. But
I would also add, Simon, another complication is that some of the most resolute friends of Israel in America are our own religious fanatics, right? Evangelical Christians are kind of backstopping American confusion in a way that you don't have in Western Europe. And it's one reason, honestly, why the prospects for Jews living outside of Israel look so much better in America than it does in Western Europe, because we have our own Christian lunatics at our backs, defending us at least until Jesus returns, only to hurl us into a lake of fire.
Yeah, when he does return, it's not going to be good.
No.
But you're right. So, yes, so the societies, so Western societies are confused and the messaging is confused. And we've seen, I hate to use the word capture, but the capture of formerly revered institutions, Harvard, the American universities, great newspapers, the BBC, and so on. And of course, the United Nations and former charities, which have now become resistance activist organizations like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, which are now completely discredited as mediators or commentators or moral judges on the region altogether. But while on one hand, treasuring human life, mourning and grieving for every civilian who is killed in this conflict that was started on October the 7th by Hamas and joined on October the 8th by Hezbollah, hence the two wars that are going on at the moment. But while bearing all that in mind, we need political leadership in the liberal democracies to regain a little bit of confidence in our values, our institutions, under fire as they are, but above all in our history and our values. And the sight of the president of a great power, the greatest power that's ever been the United States, or the prime minister of liberal democracies in Western Europe, Spain or Ireland or even Britain, being intimidated by small groups of violent fanatics, but really relatively small groups, and being intimidated by these factions, often progressive factions, who are in alliance with much more totalitarian and illiberal groups who are allied to Hamas or Hezbollah. And this unholy alliance, literally unholy, the ability of that relatively small segment of highly aggressive activists to intimidate the rulers of great powers, to navigate, to guide their foreign policy in areas that really are against the interests of those states and those societies, and actually against the wishes of the majority of voters in those countries, it turns out, as well, is a worrying sight. Mm-hmm. And it can only result in really dangerous people on the right exploiting it. And, we need leaders actually to get a bit of confidence in themselves and to back their natural allies. I think, I think Ukraine, I think Israel are natural allies of the liberal democracies in the West. And it doesn't mean that we can't criticize them in many ways. It doesn't mean that I support everything that the Israeli government does. I actually despise this Israeli government and particularly its repressions in the West Bank against Palestinians there. And I totally believe in two republics, one Jewish, one Arab, side by side in that land as soon as is possible. But first, both societies have to, first of all, reject the path of extremism, which can only lead to slaughter, misery, the death of young people, wending down into the future, the end of democracy in their societies as well. That's one path. And there is another path, which also has strong roots in both societies. You know, Israel is a democracy, and let's look at Arab societies where there is a huge tradition of tolerance, of cosmopolitanism, and that doesn't require Islamic or Islamicist power at all politically. But in the meantime, Israel has no choice but to defeat sects and factions, Hamas, Hezbollah, backed by Iran, that are bent on its destruction. And we, as Western liberal democracies, really should have no hesitation in backing the defeat of factions and sects that are against everything we believe in our societies, mm. and everything that makes liberal democracy sacred and which has made it the best system to live in, flawed in so many ways, but the best system to live in world history.
I want to return to one point you raised. I realize we're getting to the end of our hour here, Simon, and this has been wonderful to get your views on everything top to bottom here, but I just want to sharpen up one point that you touched on just in passing, and you said something about the golden age for Jews having passed. Many of us in America look at Western Europe and wonder whether life for Jews there is fast becoming untenable due to the failures of assimilation of so many Muslim immigrants who, in what proportion that remains to be seen, but in a proportion that is both obnoxious and dangerous, seem committed to some form of Islamist / jihadist way of life there. And you know, out of that falls a fairly murderous anti-Semitism. What's your view of the prospects for Judaism in Europe at this point? Is there another diaspora in the making?
You know, I think that I think Jews do have, you know, will have a future in the liberal democracies, and I think that if you look at societies like Britain, for example, the divisions are hugely exaggerated between different ethnic groups, different religions in Britain. I mean, you know, when you walk the streets of London, you see such an amazing cosmopolitan world. Mm. And there is something to be said for that argument that these sort of stresses most intensify when real mixing and real cosmopolitanism is actually thriving in a way. So I think, I don't feel as that, you know, we're living on the side, on the edge of a volcano. But what I do feel,
and
is,
can you say that? Are you including in that analysis all the countries in Western Europe, like France and Belgium, and
all of them have followed slightly different policies in creating, and some of them have created, you know, have created much more divided societies than we have in Britain. Mm. And you know what we saw in Amsterdam, for example, the other day was extremely alarming. And when one looks at that event, as so often in our conversation tonight or today, you know, you have to be able to hold two thoughts in your own mind. I mean, in Amsterdam, for example, you have to be able to recognize that, first of all, some Israeli soccer hooligans everywhere, like the factions that supported the chariot teams in ancient Constantinople, some of them are complete thugs.
Yeah.
And some of them acted in a thuggish way and did tear down Palestinian flags and what have you. What happened the next day was equally undeniable, an organized pogrom, organized on social media and hunting Jews through the streets of Amsterdam. And both these things can be true and were true. And that does reflect a crisis in Dutch society that I'm not an expert on. And so I would be careful what I said about it. But it does seem to reflect some sort of crisis in society. Mm. And I just go back to what I said, and this is what, you know, we in civil society now have a big task in America and in the Western world. One thing is not to tolerate views that are based on twisted ideologies in our institutions. We've let them get this far. And if necessary, civil society must ultimately gather itself and withdraw support, even from great institutions, be it Harvard or whatever, even the BBC, if they're incapable of separating themselves from really toxic distortions and forms of racism. But at the same time, we've got to give courage to our political leadership not to be bullied by these relatively small groups of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with if there are a few streets of people who have obnoxious views in a Western city, that shouldn't be allowed to intimidate any section of society or an elected leadership of political leaders we have elected in order to keep us safe. After all, that's the entire point of why states were formed, why we elect people in the first place. If they can't do that, then they're not doing their job. But the right of small groups of people in Western societies to hold appallingly intolerant views, they have every right to hold those views, but not to intimidate others. And that's where the line comes. And, you know, I just go back to saying that our societies need to regain their confidence in themselves. Our leaders need to be, we need to reward leaders who take these people on and who don't tolerate utterly intolerant and racist views in any part of society, be wherever it is. Then there's no problem. Because the number of people who hold these views are actually very small. Even in community, in all communities, they're a very, very small minority. But of course, as always happens in history, when one looks at revolutions and radical change is made by very small groups of dedicated vanguardists. As Lenin wrote about in What Is to Be Done, I think in 1903 or 1904, whenever he wrote it, he spotted the essence of political power is dedicated small groups. That's what's happened.
Yeah.
Small groups of people that can produce big crowds in our streets. So
that really does cut both ways. I mean, I'm comforted by the knowledge that it's such a small group of people who are very loud. And yet, when you look at instances in history like the Russian Revolution and Lenin's part in it, you can see what very small committed groups of people can accomplish when everyone else is silent.
Yeah. And that brings us back to the fact that the golden era of Jewish life, when the whole of society would unite immediately to stop these sort of threats, is over. And I think that it's alarmist to say we're in the 1930s. I mean, I think that we're more like going to have to exist in a world rather like the sort of late 19th century, where our safety is assured most of the time, but there are dangerous incidents which are very frightening, and we have to be ready for those. But those are things that were unthinkable in the golden age of Judaism and of Jewry, and that tragically died on October the 7th and 8th.
Mm.
But I do think civil society, at some point, something will happen, and civil society will empower politicians and empower its donors, its own activists, to regain control of some of these institutions. If those institutions allow themselves to be captured and lost to liberal society, to open society, then our philanthropists, our educators, our politicians will actually ultimately create new institutions that do respect those values, and people will send their children to those universities. So I think that's what will happen in America in the next 20 years.
Mm. All right, Simon, on that happy, if iconoclastic note, I'm gonna thank you for your time. It was really wonderful to talk to you.
It's wonderful to talk to you. Thank you.